Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open with Marie Johnson providing us with major news about a presidential executive order that makes sexual harassment in the military a crime. Also on our Capitol Report, hear about an East County congresswoman on an official delegation to the Ukraine amid mounting tensions in the region. Learn why hundreds of Rancho San Diego and Jamula residents are speaking out against a proposed sand mine at the Cottonwood Golf Course site along the Sweetwater River, and why one group of community activists are weighing legal action over a draft EIR that they say is so flawed it should be done over. Then we'll have news about an arson arrest in El Cajon for the burning of several bank ATMs. We'll also have news on the county's recently approved ordinance allowing home kitchen businesses in our region. Elijah McKee will have a special report today on the blocking of voting rights legislation in the U.S. Senate and what's at stake for our democracy. Then, we'll have a report on an anticipated shortage of police and sheriff officers in our region, the likely reasons for that shortage, and action taken at the request of East County's supervisors to address the problem and protect public safety. There is a ballot initiative coming up that would weaken California's lemon law protecting vehicle buyers, and we'll have details from California News Service. Mitchell Murphy will report on a new study showing just how dramatically COVID-19 boosters are at saving lives and keeping people out of hospitals. We'll report on congressional leaders calling for an investigation into the Border Patrol's shadowy forces accused of covering up crimes by Border Patrol agents. The county has issued a drinking water alert for Cameron Corners in Campo due to nitrate contamination, and we'll have details. We'll also have information on the sentencing of a man convicted of participating in the burning down of the historic Randall Lamb Building during a riot in La Mesa back in 2020. Hear about that earthquake that rattled our region Sunday morning, and then on the Yonder Report from Public News Service, we'll have some stories for rural residents, including how to get those free COVID tests from the federal government, farmers as storytellers, and more. Next, we'll take you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hecumbe Hot Springs, revisiting one of our Best of East County episodes. From Public News Service, we'll have a few national and international news stories, including the future of Winter Olympics without snow, new abortion rights restrictions on the horizon, and more. Now, if you lost a loved one to COVID-19, hear about how you can get reimbursed for funeral expenses from FEMA. And finally, now that fire season is year-round in California, we'll have some emergency preparedness tips for you and your family. We would also like to encourage everyone listening to please make a donation at knsj.org to help the station cover over $3,000 in emergency expenses of its own to get back on the air after an ice storm damaged the transmitter high atop Monument Peak at Mount Laguna near our home base in Descanso. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Marie Johnson with a Capitol Report. President Joe Biden has signed an executive order making sexual harassment a criminal offense under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The action stems from the 2020 murder of Vanessa Guillen by a fellow soldier in Fort Hood, Texas. Her family says she was sexually assaulted before she was killed, but was afraid to report the assault due to fear of retaliation. The Guillen family lobbied for actions to protect military women victimized by sexual harassment. A New York Times report in August 2021 found that nearly 1 in 4 U.S. servicewomen report being sexually assaulted in the military, but too often assailants are not held accountable. The president's executive order implements key recommendations of the Independent Review Commission on Sexual Assault in the Military, launched by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin last March, and is key to advancing the bipartisan Military Justice Reform Bill passed by Congress and signed into law last month. It also includes key elements of the I Am Vanessa Guillen Act. In signing the executive order, Biden said signing of the executive order along with recently passed congressional legislation represents, quote, a historic shift of legal decisions from commanders to independent specialized prosecutors in cases of sexual assault, domestic violence, and other serious crimes, and we honor the courage and leadership of the many survivors and advocates who long fought for these critical changes. According to White House officials, the executive order will also strengthen the military's response to domestic violence incidents and increase penalties for service members who share intimate photos or videos without permission.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The deadline to submit comments to the county on the proposed Cottonwood sand mine along the Sweetwater River in Rancho San Diego, next to a federal wildlife preserve, has been extended until February 28th at 4 p.m. The county held an online meeting January 19th in response to a request for a major use permit for the sand mine's draft environmental impact statement. Hundreds of people signed on to participate despite major technical issues. An earlier in-person public meeting was canceled due to COVID-19, but the public can still weigh in at a February 1st meeting of the Valle de Oro Planning Group at 7 p.m., as well as by sending comments to the county. Now, you can find links to send comments or to attend the virtual Valle de Oro Planning Group meeting on our website at eastcountymagazine.org in the Green Scene section. The recent online meeting that was held was fraught with technical difficulties from the onset. Different login instructions were distributed, and some community members trying to access the presentation were logged into a non-operational site. About 300 people did manage to log in and attend the virtual meeting, and they voiced overwhelming opposition. Mark Slovic, Deputy Director of Planning and Development Services for the county, presided over the meeting and presented an overview of the draft Environmental Impact Report, or EIR. He encouraged the public to send feedback, adding that ultimately the county's Planning Commission will vote, after which the Board of Supervisors will make the final decision. Due to the technical difficulties, the county will hold another public input meeting, which has not yet been scheduled, Slovic said. Barry Jantz, a leader in the StopCottonwoodSandMine.org group, made a detailed presentation outlining the many objections to the proposed sand mine. The group is considering legal action. Jantz called the draft EIR a flawed and incomplete document that does not adequately analyze significant environmental impacts of the potential project to the people, wildlife, water, air, and roads of the community. Additionally, the sand mine project does not propose adequate mitigation measures or alternatives to address those impacts, he added. Jantz also listed 20 specific items in the EIR that he said do not comply with goals, policies, or requirements of the county's general plan and the Valle de Oro Community Plan. He concluded, "Our findings are that the draft EIR is incomplete and not in compliance with CEQA, that's the California Environmental Quality Act, and therefore," he said, "it must be revised and reissued to the public for review." Many of the participants posted their comments in the chat section of the online teleconference. Colleen Austell-Nadeau opposes the project. She asked, "What happens to the well water of those who have wells near the project?" noting that sand currently filters the water and prevents flooding. She also asked about impacts to endangered species, such as burrowing owls, that burrow in the sand. Stephanie Young stated, "Silica dust is a huge issue for public health, not to mention valley fever." Todd Schilling asked why the draft EIR made no mention of a school across the street from the project site. A commenter named AJ also voiced concerns over the children's health, adding, "In addition, the noise will interrupt classroom instruction and learning." Kathy Ellis asked, "Where did the study address loss of property value?" It doesn't. Christopher Youssef said the project would cause 10 years of environmental damage and health hazards. He called it a plague to community life, adding, "The project will drive homeowners away or make them suffer through a decade of noise, pollution, and traffic. Additionally, this will diminish real estate values and do nothing for community growth. It would tarnish people's livelihoods." Yasmin, who did not provide a last name, cited concerns over noise, traffic, and environmental impacts, and astonishment that the draft EIR found the project would have less than significant impacts on these factors. Another participant asked, has anyone reached out to the California Coastal Commission for an environmental impact report for all watersheds downstream of the sand mine? Liz Laverto objected to heavy water use by the project developer during drought. Kathy Ellis asked, what protections will be in place in the event the developer goes bankrupt prior to completion of reclamation? Not everyone was opposed to the sand mine. Paul, who did not post his last name, said the project has many positives for the community, but he did not state what any of those are. Another participant, using the nickname Joe Mama, posted, down with the golf course and hooray for the sand mine. But again, he did not list reasons for his support or whether he may be affiliated with the sand mine developer. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Mitchell Murphy with the Crime Beat Report. El Cajon police have arrested 29-year-old Valerie Eliezer on multiple counts of arson and parole violations. She is accused of setting fire to several ATM machines at Bank of the West on East Main Street on January 25th. El Cajon fire and police officers responded to reports of the fires, which caused extensive property damage to the unoccupied buildings, but no injuries. Images of the arsonists were caught on surveillance cameras at the bank and surrounding areas. According to Lieutenant Randy Solard with El Cajon Police, officers recognized the suspect as a local homeless woman. 2 days later, officers found Eliezer in the same area as the arson fires and booked her into the Las Colinas Detention Facility. She is currently on probation for a prior arson and had a cigarette lighter at the time of her arrest, which is a violation of her probation. Lieutenant Solard said Eliezer also has an extensive criminal history, including arrests for terrorist threats, brandishing a deadly weapon, robbery, and assault. El Cajon Police Department is asking that anyone with information regarding these crimes call the El Cajon Police Department or San Diego Crime Stoppers.
San Diego County Supervisors voted unanimously on January 26th to adopt a local ordinance allowing micro-enterprise home kitchen operations, or MECOs, on a temporary 2-year basis. Apartments, leased spaces, and houses will all be considered private homes. The county cautions future home cooks to check their lease and be sure a MECO is allowed. Multiple people are not allowed to each operate a MECO or cottage food operation in one residence. Applications to start a home kitchen business will be accepted in February, and training workshops will be provided for future home kitchen cooks. The County Department of Environmental Health and Quality will be the local enforcement agency overseeing operations. More information on MECOs, such as a startup checklist of requirements, will be coming soon. Supervisor Joel Anderson partnered with Vice Chair Nora Vargas in proposing that the County of San Diego adopt MECOs as allowed under a new statewide program. MECOs will not only help aspiring restaurateurs who want to put their food to the test first on a small scale, but can also serve as a supplemental income source for stay-at-home parents and others. Anderson calls the program a win for the chefs and a win for the community. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Fears that Russia aims to invade the Ukraine have grown in recent weeks after Russia sent an estimated 100,000 troops to the Ukrainian border, staged military exercises there, and demanded that NATO deny admission to the former Soviet bloc nation. The U.S. has sent arms to the Ukraine and warned Russian President Vladimir Putin of severe sanctions if he orders an attack on the Ukraine, which U.S. President Joe Biden says would be the largest invasion since World War II, adding it would change the world. This week, San Diego Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs traveled to the Ukraine and Belgium as part of an official bipartisan congressional delegation organized by Chairman Gregory Meeks of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The bipartisan delegation has been meeting with NATO allies and European Union counterparts to discuss the increased threat of Russian military action in Ukraine. Jacobs, a Democrat, is a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Armed Services Committee. Prior to the trip, Jacobs released a statement to media indicating she looked forward to meeting with NATO and EU officials in Belgium and the Ukraine. It is imperative that we support an international order based on the right of people to choose their own future, Jacobs says. She adds, I condemn Russia's destabilization actions in Ukraine and intend to push for continued diplomatic efforts to de-escalate this crisis because an escalation into armed conflict would be disastrous for everyone involved, particularly the Ukrainian people. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
KNSJ is back on the air after a winter storm and ice caused major damage to the transmitter on Monument Peak at Mount Laguna. Now, it cost over $3,000 for these repairs, and the station is seeking donations to help cover this unexpected cost. So please go to knsj.org and make a donation to help support independent news in the public interest for our region.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Elijah McKee with a special report on voting rights. 1 year into the Biden administration, with the 2022 midterm elections on the horizon, Congress's tug of war over federal voting rights legislation continues to escalate. On January 19th, Senate Republicans blocked Democrats' efforts to pass both the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The legislation, which was also blocked several times in 2021, sought to strengthen the protections of voters in light of many recent state laws that suppress voting rights. Such laws have been levied across the nation in the wake of the 2020 presidential election and the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, recently warned, "Our voting rights and our democracy are on the line." The protective legislation would have established a federal holiday on Election Day, mail-in voting and early voting in every state, and nationwide ballot drop. The pair of bills also would have addressed gerrymandering, the biased drawing of districts to favor a particular party. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer attempted to push the Voting Rights Act through by proposing to remove the Senate filibuster rule that requires a 60-vote majority to pass a bill. In the current Senate, which is split 50-50, this maneuver would have allowed the legislation a fighting chance. Importantly, the filibuster rule also faces opposition for its long history dating back to Jim Crow-era blockades of civil rights. Yet Schumer and President Biden alike faced difficulty in uniting the Democratic Party behind them in this effort. Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona staunchly swung the vote in favor of upholding the filibuster, effectively killing the Voting Rights Act in their current form. The legislation will likely be reformed and tested on the Senate floor yet again in the coming months, after previously winning passage in the House of Representatives. San Diego's representatives divided down party lines, with all four local Democrats voting in favor and the region's lone Republican opposed. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat who represents much of East County, says in a press release, "If we are not vigilant in protecting rights and strengthening our democratic institutions, they will be eroded. It's happening right now." Her colleague, Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who represents a large portion of East County as well, took the opposite stance. In his press release, he stated, "The nation should understand that Biden and the Democrats are trying to stop the voters from having their rightful say because they know a fair election will be a disaster for them in November." These two standpoints are clearly conflicting and are indicative of the partisan divide in Congress and the nation. Protections for voters are on the table, yet both sides accuse the other of suppressing voting rights. Given these contradictions within the discourse of public officials, how can people know where the genuine risk to voters and our democracy lies? The recent record of voting legislation provides some clear evidence. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, at least 19 states passed 34 laws restricting access to voting in 2021, all in Republican-controlled areas. Notably, Georgia passed its Election Integrity Act, or SB 202, last year, which went so far as to criminalize poll workers giving water to voters waiting in long lines. While the surge is sudden and connected to what some call the big lie that Trump won the 2020 election, the new laws only add to the stack of suppressive policies that have hurt voters throughout history, from poll taxes to providing fewer voting stations in black neighborhoods than in white communities. The current laws restrict access to the ballot box from multiple angles, be it voter registration and identification, mail-in voting, early voting, and district mapping. Such measures were proposed under the guise of unfounded voter fraud claims in the 2020 election. Here are the facts. Over 60 judges found no fraud in the 2020 presidential election, including several judges appointed by Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the Senate committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol continues to subpoena those connected to the Trump inner circle, such as advisors Rudy Giuliani and Boris Epstein. The committee has found evidence of an alternate elector plot, in which fake pro-Trump electors submitted votes to Congress, and even a draft plan by Trump allies to seize voting machines, according to CNN and The Hill. Restrictive voting laws hurt democracy and all Americans, but they disproportionately harm people of color and indigenous voters in this country. San Diego Representative Jacobs affirms, "The nationwide assault on voting rights, especially the voting rights of community of color, requires federal action." According to the ACLU, counties with more minorities have fewer polling places to support their vote, as do those living on reservation land. However, people of color also have a harder time getting leave from work to vote. Since Election Day is not yet a federal holiday, many struggle to cast their vote even if there is a polling place a mile away. The recently stymied Freedom to Vote Act would have protected and expanded access in each of these areas. In addition, the update to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would have restored the pre-clearance component of the original 1965 law, which requires states with histories of voter suppression to obtain federal approval before changing their voting policies. At this moment, the fact that suppressive laws were passed by Republicans in red states and protective bills were introduced by Democrats is a rallying cry that may obscure the very real threat to democracy if Americans are denied their rights to vote. As journalist Barton Gellman said on a recent webinar hosted by the University of California Irvine Law Center, Trump is actually in a better position, paradoxically, now that he's not the president, to subvert the next election. Gellman authored the December cover story of The Atlantic, titled "Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun." He discussed with the panel the reality that what Trump could not do as president due to the checks of other governmental bodies, such as the Pentagon, he could very well accomplish this time around through smaller-scale GOP efforts to change the rules around voting in many states. Margaret Sullivan, Washington Post columnist and former editor at the New York Times, was also a panelist at the seminar on how journalists can accurately report on the issue of voting and elections right now. She said, "We want to be fair to all parties, but we want to be fair to the audience, the reader, the news consumer, also known as the American citizen. As the next cycle of federal elections approaches, the news media must choose to what extent they place protecting democracy within their mandate as an institution dedicated to the public interest. Journalists have an obligation to remain objective and provide views on all sides, but also to report the truth when one side is airing falsehoods that threaten to undermine our democratic system and right to vote." For more information on how to protect your voice and improve voting access, you can visit the nonprofit CalVoter website at calvoter.org.
San Diego County Supervisors on January 25th unanimously approved a request by East County Supervisors Joel Anderson and Jim Desmond to resolve the anticipated shortage of law enforcement officers. Their request came as vaccine mandates, retirements, COVID-19, recruitment and retention issues have all impacted staffing levels. The board directed the chief administrative officer to work with the sheriff's department and return with updates and practical recommendations to address future public safety staffing shortages. A survey by the San Diego Police Officers Association in September found that about 90% of SDPD officers said they oppose vaccine mandates and 45% say they would rather be fired than comply. It remains to be seen how many will actually choose to lose their jobs rather than get vaccinated once the city of San Diego starts firing officers who refuse to comply with the new mandate. Now, the sheriff's department does not have a vaccine mandate, but still, applications to the sheriff's department dropped 25% over the last year and 36% from 2018 to 2021. As of December, only 43% of the county's 2,400 sheriff's deputies had been vaccinated, the Union Tribune reports. It's unclear whether the drop in applications may be linked to fear of a possible future vaccine mandate, to fear of contracting COVID-19 on the job, or other reasons. COVID-19 has also taken a toll in the ranks of police here and elsewhere. COVID is now the top killer of law enforcement officers in California and the nation, as we recently reported. In 2020 and 2021, 476 officers lost their lives to COVID-19 nationwide, far higher than any other line of duty cause. As of October last year, two sheriff's officers working in corrections here had died of COVID, which can also increase sick leave and disability. While not having a vaccine mandate may boost retention, albeit at greater health risk to those whom officers interact with, lack of a mandate can also potentially increase liability for the county. Civil rights attorneys recently filed an injunction against the sheriff seeking protection for clients in county jails where COVID infections and deaths are rampant among inmates and staff. More than 2,500 people serving time in county jails have been infected with COVID-19. Many have been hospitalized and several have died. The Omicron surge has strained police agencies statewide, forcing some to increase overtime, reduce services, and reroute non-emergency calls to online portals, a CalMatters poll of over 30 agencies in California found. Yuba County, which has the state's highest COVID hospitalization rate, had its sheriff calling in reserve officers as the virus spread through its ranks, while Mount Shasta had half its police force out with COVID, forcing the police chief himself to pull duty shifts and dispatchers to work 7 days in a row. Attrition in the ranks may also be related to new police oversight at state and local levels in the wake of recent racial justice protests and reforms. That includes citizens' oversight panels in several local jurisdictions, body-worn cameras, and new California reporting requirements on serious use of force incidents. Staffing shortages come at a time when more prisoners are being released early to reduce crowding in jails and slow the spread of COVID. Statewide, some crimes, such as smash-and-grab retail thefts, are on the rise, although it's unclear whether short-staffing of police was a factor in those. But short-staffing unquestionably increases response times and investigations of some crimes. Options to improve retention and recruitment could include educating officers on the real risks of COVID-19 in their profession, perhaps easing mandates, bolstering recruitment requirements within the community, including communities of color, and beyond the county borders, increasing pay or benefits, and other factors. The Sheriff's Department provides law enforcement to 9 incorporated cities in San Diego County, including Lemon Grove and Santee here in East County, as well as the vast unincorporated areas that encompass rural, mountain, and desert towns. The Sheriff's Department also plays an important role as the Regional Mutual Aid Coordinator. Deputies respond to help cities during times of need, such as the riot in La Mesa in 2020, as well as helping to evacuate people during wildfires. The Sheriff's Department also supports both unincorporated and incorporated areas of the county through regional services such as the Crime Lab, helicopter searches, a SWAT team, bomb arson investigators, search and rescue missions, and more. Supervisor Anderson thanked his fellow supervisors for taking action to help assure that county residents will feel safe and protected at a time when the city of San Diego alone could lose hundreds of officers. Supervisor Desmond concludes, "Public safety is the number one priority for government. Families and communities must feel safe. With violent crime rising, it is imperative that San Diego County have the necessary public safety officers." Desmond says men and women who put themselves in harm's way to protect others are now facing burnout from staffing shortages, and he wants to assure that officers have the tools needed to help them succeed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Consumer advocates are speaking out against a proposed ballot initiative that would reform California's so-called Lemon Law. Current law allows people who have been defrauded or sold a defective product to sue for damages plus attorney's fees. The ballot initiative would limit the plaintiff's attorneys to 20% of the amount recovered. Longtime activist Rosemary Shahan founded Consumers for Auto Reliability and Safety. She says that change would hobble the victims, but says nothing about the amount big companies can spend to defend the suits.
It would make it practically impossible for consumers to get an attorney and fight back in court when they've been victimized by a really unsafe product or fraud.
The initiative was written by the Civil Justice Association of California, or CJAC, a group Shahan says is backed by more than a dozen big corporations, including car manufacturers, oil companies, pharmaceutical companies, telecoms, and banks. Unverified reports emerged over the weekend that CJAC may halt its efforts to gather signatures, but President Kyla Christopherson Powell said in a statement, quote, "We intend to pursue our measure and are evaluating our options in light of COVID and other factors." She also has said that plaintiffs' attorneys are abusing current laws, dragging out litigation for profit. Shahan says California's trailblazing Lemon Law has drawn fire for decades.
At CJAC, their executive director has met with me over the years and, you know, tried to persuade us to weaken California's Lemon Law in various ways. And I've always just said no. So I think they're just frustrated.
To qualify for the ballot, the initiative backers would need to attract more than 623,000 signatures, which is 5% of the people who voted in the last election for governor. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is Mitchell Murphy with the health report. New research findings released by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control shows that COVID-19 vaccine boosters are effective at preventing severe illness and hospitalizations. The boosters reduced emergency room visits and hospitalizations by 94% and reduced the death rate by 90% compared to patients who had not received booster shots. Despite that, just under 50% of San Diegans who are fully vaccinated have received a booster, according to the County Health and Human Services Agency. That means over 1 million county residents are due for a booster. Boosters are currently available for everyone 12 years and older. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says while we are seeing more breakthrough infections due to the COVID-19 Omicron variant, research has shown that significantly fewer people who have received their booster are getting seriously ill and ending up in the hospital. Of the 996 hospitalizations reported in the 30 days from December 14th through January 12th, 91% had not received booster shots. Dr. Wooten says San Diegans should get a booster immediately if they are eligible. Nearly one quarter of all COVID-19 test results have been positive in the most recent data available as the fast-spreading Omicron variant continues to impact our region. The county has more than 400 vaccination sites, including pharmacies, medical providers, clinics, and county locations. You can make an appointment or find a site near you by calling 833-422-4255 or visiting the MyTurn or coronavirus-sd.com websites.
10 House and Senate committee chairs have sent a letter to the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, requesting an investigation into the Border Patrol's critical incident teams along the southern border region. In addition, the chairs of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform and the House Committee on Homeland Security have published a letter seeking information by February 7th about potential misconduct of these specialized and shadowy teams. The actions come after a letter sent by the Southern Border Communities Coalition, or SBCC, in October to congressional oversight committees requesting an investigation into alleged cover-ups by agents and leadership to limit their liability in cases of excessive use of force and deaths. The SBCC accuses these shadowy groups of serving as, quote, cover-up teams to alter government documents, destroy evidence, disperse witnesses, withhold evidence, and intrude on autopsies. These records unearthed by members of SBCC point to what may be the largest and longest-standing shadow police unit operating in the federal government today, their press release states. The units began in the San Diego region back in 1987 and soon spread to other areas. They go by various names, such as sector evidence teams and evidence collection teams. Their stated purpose is to mitigate civil liability for agents. The SBCC calls these groups unlawful. The Border Patrol has remained silent on the allegations to date. Vicky Gobeka, director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition, said, "Border Patrol cannot and should not investigate itself. We urge GAO investigators to conduct a thorough and transparent investigation of these shadow teams to ensure our border communities are no longer harmed and that the families who have lost a loved one can have closure, adding, justice can no longer be delayed. Andrea Guerrero, Executive Director of Alliance San Diego and co-counsel for the family of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas in a case before the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, says these teams must be fully investigated and shut down. Moreover, prosecutors must bring charges where they have obstructed justice, from the killing of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas to the shooting of Marisol Garcia. Only then, she says, can we begin to trust that investigations are impartial and conducted to protect the public. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice. This is Miriam Raftery.
This is Marie Johnson with a health alert. The County of San Diego's Department of Environmental Health and Quality has advised the public that a drinking water warning has been issued for Cameron Corners Water System in Campo. The water system supplies water to a convenience store, restaurant, and office retail space. Water sample results reported January 26th showed that nitrate levels exceeded the maximum contaminant level for safe drinking water. Nitrates in drinking water are a health concern, especially for infants less than 6 months old and pregnant women who should not drink the water. Boiling, freezing, filtering, or letting water stand does not reduce the nitrate level. Nitrates in drinking water arise from natural, industrial, or agricultural sources, including septic systems, stormwater runoff, and fertilizers. The drinking water warning will remain in effect until laboratory results confirm that treatment of the water has resulted in nitrate levels that are within state standards. Nitrate contamination can sometimes be difficult to treat. Some residents in nearby Lake Morena, also a community in Campo, have been without drinkable tap water for over 2 years due to nitrate pollution, as East County Magazine recently reported.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. 44-year-old Daniel Luis Sandoval of Campo has been sentenced for his role in the burning down of the historic Randall Lamb Building in La Mesa during civil unrest in May 2020. According to the prosecution, Sandoval pulled pages from a book and tossed them onto a fire ignited by others who used Molotov cocktails to set the blaze, but those other suspects remain at large. Sandoval pleaded guilty last year to arson as well as vandalism at a nearby spa business. He has spent nearly a year in jail while awaiting sentencing. He received probation, as well as a 6-month suspended sentence. Now, if he violates terms of probation, he will be imprisoned to serve that 6-year sentence. According to Deputy District Attorney Joe McLaughlin, mitigating factors included past trauma and substance abuse issues. Sandoval is now undergoing drug rehabilitation. 3 buildings burned to the ground during that La Mesa riot, which followed an earlier racial justice protest as part of national demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd, a black suspect by a white police officer in Minneapolis later found guilty of murder. Chase Bank and Union Bank in downtown La Mesa were also destroyed by fires during the riot. Ricky Bernard Cooper pleaded guilty in the Chase Bank arson, and he also received a 2-year probation, though a case against another suspect in that crime remains pending. After Cooper's probation sentence, La Mesa Councilwoman Laura Lothian called the sentence reckless leniency, adding, "Hundreds of La Mesans expressed to me their dismay and disquiet at this sentence that can't even be called a slap on the wrist. I hope this lapse in responsible judgment from the DA's office does not make La Mesa vulnerable to future attacks." No arrests have yet been made for the arson at Union Bank. One protester, Zachary Alexander Karras, was convicted last summer of bringing Molotov cocktails to the protest. He was sentenced to 33 months in federal prison, ironically, a longer sentence than those charged with actual arson received. And now we have some national news headlines for you from Public News Service.
An earthquake measuring 4.0 on the Richter scale struck about 5 kilometers west-southwest of Palomar Observatory Sunday morning in North San Diego County, the U.S. Geological Service reports. That's about 18 miles northeast of Escondido. The shaking was felt as far away as Mexico to the south, Santa Maria to the north, and Yuma, Arizona to the east. No injuries or damage have been reported as yet. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. The post office is busy shipping free at-home COVID-19 tests, taxpayer-funded, of course.
It's a way the federal government is able to actually contact everyone in this country, really, so it speaks to the value of the postal service.
Christopher Shaw, U.S. postal historian, says people without mail delivery to their homes can get mail from postal boxes or even general delivery for free. An additional issue, access to a good internet connection to order the free tests.
And if you're in a rural place where you don't really have access to the internet, then how are you going to use the website to order in the first place?
The National Farmers Union is gathering real-life stories from struggling farm families facing a historical challenge of a different sort, monopolies. Today, 4 massive corporations control over 75% of the global grain trade. Sandra Brown has more.
The 5-month-old nationwide Fairness for Farmers campaign is highlighting the harm heaped on farmers from corporate consolidation, forcing down prices paid to farmers, ranchers, and fishers.
One of the challenges we have stem from lack of competition, fewer choices, and abuse of market power by corporate monopolies.
Mike Strands with the National Farmers Union. The union hopes a collection of personal stories will help policymakers modernize antitrust laws to promote fair competition.
Our greatest asset is the experience of our members and our members' ability and willingness to share that.
I'm Xander Brown.
Some pandemic adjustments are triggering longer-term healthcare changes. Volunteer advanced practice registered nurses known as APRNs do some heavy lifting in rural areas, and there's a push towards fewer restrictions on how they practice.
During this whole pandemic, we have really shown that, yeah, we can provide a great service to patients and to those vulnerable populations that really need us.
Nursing professor Amanda Culp Roach, University of North Carolina, Wilmington, had to stop volunteering at a rural clinic when her first supervising physician retired until she found another. An unnecessary burden, she believes, although the American Medical Association maintains that doctors are needed to oversee the work of APRNs. Not all endangered species are lovable, but the bat has a particularly bad rap now with a potential COVID connection. One bat made the top 10 list of those imperiled by climate change in a report from the Endangered Species Coalition, the Mexican long-nosed bat. Kristen Lear with Bat Conservation International says the rare Texas and New Mexico pollinator is critical for a happy hour favorite, the margarita.
They feed on these gigantic agave plants, which we probably all know of from making tequila and mezcal.
With development reducing the number of agave plants, Lear says people along the bat 700-mile southwest migration also can help.
Many people put up hummingbird feeders, which obviously attract hummingbirds, but also at night attract these nectar-feeding bats.
For the Yonder Report and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Next up, we're going to play one of our best of East County favorites, taking you on the road to the Desert View Tower in Hakumba Hot Springs.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Hayden Parsley, on the road in Hakumba Hot Springs for East County Magazine. You can take a trip into California's past at the Desert View Tower, a quirky and whimsical relic of the past that is still open to the public here in San Diego's East County. Located just off Interstate 8 at the Incapa exit, the tower is poised on a rocky overlook surrounded by desert on all sides. Built in the 1920s by Bert Vaughn, a real estate tycoon who owned much of Hakumba, this 70-foot watchtower has become a tourist attraction and a local landmark on the outskirts of the small town known as Hakumba Hot Springs. Originally built to commemorate the area's rough pre-highway history, the tower houses a small museum filled with artifacts and oddities of California's history, including our region's Native American, Spanish, and pioneer past. The top floor of the tower is an observation deck, with a coin-fed telescope that provides a breathtaking view of Imperial Valley and the Anza-Borrego Desert, though now somewhat marred by a wind farm. In 1950, a gift shop was added around the base of the tower. The shop still operates today and is filled with an eclectic mix of items such as geodes, gems and minerals, vintage postcards, historic and travel books on our region, arts and crafts items such as handmade Tecate tiles, onyx bookends, musical instruments, carved animal sculptures, and more. Roaming this area of the tower are the owner's many friendly dogs that add to the rustic charm of the location. You can also get a workout pumping a player piano while listening to old-time tunes. While I was there, the wind was gusting. It was a bit chilly and I wished I had a better coat when I reached the top. The owner says this is atypical though, and that it is warm and sunny most days. The proprietor, Ben Schultz, has many colorful stories on East County's history, culture, and colorful characters, having operated the site for many years. Boulder Park at the Desert View Tower was created in 1933 by an unemployed engineer, Merle Ratcliffe, who was out of work during the Great Depression. He sculpted reptiles and fanciful animals out of the huge stone boulders. I didn't get a chance to tour these, which will be an adventure for another time.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
And now we have some national news headlines for you from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, January the 31st, 2022. I'm Mike Clifford. Republicans in the Florida legislature are fast-tracking a 15-week abortion ban over the objections of activists and medical professionals.
Last Thursday, student activists chanted, "Let us speak," after the committee chairperson, Representative Brian Avila, cut off public comment to give committee members time to debate. The bill was approved on a party-line vote. It states a physician may not perform a termination of pregnancy if the physician determines the gestational age of the fetus is more than 15 weeks. Dr. Guy Ben-Ruby, a Jacksonville-based obstetrician and gynecologist, says the rule is problematic for a number of reasons.
We have some women that only have three cycles a year. How is this woman going to know that she hasn't had a cycle this month because she's pregnant? And you know, 15 weeks is 3.5 months. She may not have a period during the 3.5 months.
The ban includes an exception if the pregnant person's health is at risk, but there are no exceptions for rape or incest. The legislature has a GOP majority, and Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has already signaled his support for the ban. The bill has one final committee stop this week before a House vote. I'm Tramell Gomes.
The 2022 Olympic Games scheduled to open in Beijing this week. But new research shows unless world leaders make significant progress toward mitigating climate change, they could be the last Winter Games.
The report finds in most parts of the world, including Colorado and the American West, winter sports venues say the natural snowfalls they depend on to operate are no longer reliable. The Beijing Games will be the first ever produced with 100% artificial snow. Maddie Orr, founder of the Global Sports Ecology Group, says the warming climate presents a major obstacle for winter sports.
What we're starting to see is snow is going away. So it's going to be a challenge moving forward to identify those places where you're going to have a snow-sure condition to host an event without relying extensively on artificial snow.
A sports ecology group, Save Our Winters, report out this week warns that shifting climate patterns in Colorado and around the world are producing an ever-shrinking snowpack, which has decreased by a total of 35 inches since the 1970s. Mark Richardson reporting.
The next Winter Games are scheduled for 2026 in Milan and Cortina, Italy. And USA Today reports parts of the Northeast were buried in up to 30 inches of snow Sunday. Authorities on Long Island reported 3 storm-related deaths. Meantime, USA Today notes that Boston tied its record for the biggest single-day snowfall on Saturday with 23.6 inches. This is PNS. The Omicron variant of COVID-19 has led to the greatest spike of the virus in Montana since the start of the pandemic. More on that now from Eric Tegadoff.
While some might consider getting the virus inevitable when cases are so high, it still has more dangerous consequences for certain populations. People who have compromised immune systems, such as people receiving treatment for cancer, recent organ transplant recipients, or those with rare disorders, still have a higher risk of severe reaction to COVID-19. Billings Clinic epidemiologist Dr. Neil Koo says the relaxed attitude toward the pandemic has potentially harmful consequences for some.
Especially kind of exacerbated by the notion that, well, this disease is milder and we're going to get it anyway, so why bother? It's troubling because it may not be as a big deal for you, but a good chance it could be a very big deal for someone else.
Nearly 3,000 Montanans have died from the virus, and there are nearly 20,000 active cases across the state, according to the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services.
Salt marshes in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia struggling to cope with the effects of sea level rise.
On Masonboro Island, North Carolina, scientists are spotting signs of change from rising seas. In 2016, researchers reported a section of the salt marsh south of Wrightsville Beach was sinking by 1.9 millimeters per year. Their research followed 5 years of monitoring. Dr. Brandon Puckett with the North Carolina Division of Coastal Management explains the region's salt marshes are weakening.
I sort of liken it to the effect that stress has on the human body. The symptoms may not be apparent immediately, but over time, the symptoms of chronic stress take a toll on our bodies, right? And they become apparent. Sea level rise is that chronic stressor for salt marshes.
He adds sea level rise is also depleting grasses that hold the marsh at Masonboro Island together. Nadia Rumligan reporting.
Finally, our Mike Bowen tells us the winter already has seen some North Dakotans crank up their thermostats amid some cold stretches.
Xcel Energy has a request before state regulators for a 10.5% rate increase. Consumer advocates worry some bills could increase by as much as 15%. Under the plan, the fixed charge for delivering gas would go up by nearly $6. AARP's Josh Askvig says that's too much considering what residents already are paying.
The current charge is already too high, and we understand how that can decrease household control over their heating bills.
The current monthly charge is more than $18. Xcel says it hasn't made this kind of request in the state in 15 years.
And this is Mike Clifford, and thank you for starting your week with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, heard on interesting radio stations. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Over 850,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, but many families don't know about a federal program that can pay for funeral expenses such as burial or cremation. The program will pay up to $9,000 per death, or a maximum of $35,000 per application if someone paid for funerals for multiple people. To be eligible, you must be a U.S. citizen, non-citizen national, or qualified alien, and have paid funeral expenses on or after January 20th, 2020, for someone whose death was caused or likely caused by COVID-19. The person must have died in the United States or in a U.S. territory. Applications are taken only by phone, not online. To apply, call the COVID-19 Funeral Assistance Hotline at 844-684-6333, Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The program is funded through the Biden administration's Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act and the American Rescue Plan Act. It is administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. You can find more information at FEMA.gov, that's FEMA.gov, then type COVID funeral into the search bar. But you can only apply by telephone by calling 844-684-6333. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
KNSJ is back on the air after a winter storm and ice caused major damage to the transmitter on Monument Peak at Mount Laguna. Now, it cost over $3,000 for these repairs, and the station is seeking donations to help cover this unexpected cost. So please go to knsj.org and make a donation to help support independent news in the public interest for our region. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ bringing you some special information on how to prepare for fire season, which is now year-round. How prepared are you for an emergency? Just as you change your smoke detector batteries whenever you change your clocks for daylight savings time, it's also a smart idea to check your emergency kit at the start of every fire season. That means now. Of course, emergencies such as an earthquake or a blackout can happen at any time with no advance warning. For households with children, elderly people, or those with limited mobility, being ready to take action is especially important. Updating your emergency list should start with a checklist. Did you add or lose any members of your household? Be sure to have enough supplies for everyone, including people and pets. Check the dates on canned goods and other perishables, and be sure that stored drinking water is still good. Create an emergency plan for your family. Identify two places for the family to meet. One should be somewhere outside your home, but close by, perhaps a neighbor's or a street corner. The other should be a spot away from your neighborhood, just in case the entire area is evacuated and you can't return. Using information from SDG&E and supplementing it with some additional tips, we've come up with the following helpful suggestions to be prepared. Practice an evacuation plan with your family, including children. If they get used to doing something when there is no panic, they will be much less frantic should a real disaster strike. Review emergency plans at your workplace, your child's school or daycare center, friends' homes, and other places where members of your family regularly spend time. Plan safe routes away from your home and business to high, safe ground, and be sure all family members know the routes. Have alternative routes in mind if the first option is blocked. Develop a plan for family pets and livestock, and have a backup plan because some evacuation shelters may not allow animals. Designate a friend or family member outside the area who all family members can call if you become separated, and that way you can know if everyone is safe. Have family members memorize that phone number in case cell phones die and you can't access the phone directory. Keep current important documents in a safe deposit box or send copies outside the area to be kept by a trusted relative or friend. Be sure that you can access your insurance policy and have a copy of your deed, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, when banks were destroyed by flooding and hurricanes, many homeowners had a lot of trouble putting in their insurance claims. Have a set place for your emergency supplies. Your emergency kit should include, at minimum, a 3-day supply of bottled water, 1 gallon per person per day, plus extra for pets or anyone with special needs, a 3-day supply of packaged, dried, and canned food that can be prepared without cooking, a first aid kit, and essential medicines for all family members, a pet carrier for each pet and pet food, a manual can opener, a portable radio, plenty of batteries and flashlights kept in waterproof bags, an extra set of car keys, credit cards, and always plenty of cash in case the power is out when ATM machines and credit card machines are not working. Special items for infants, elderly, or disabled family members. It's also important to make sure that you always keep plenty of gas in your car since pumps won't work when the power goes out. Also, be sure you have a car charger for your cell phones, since during a power outage, you don't want your cell phone to go dead. Car chargers are cheap, often less than $10, but can be crucial in an emergency. Know how to operate everything if the electricity is off, the keyless entry to your home, and an electric garage door and gates, for instance. Be sure you know how to open them manually. If you have a gas main, know how to shut it off in case of a leak or a disaster. Include instructions on how to shut off anything that's complicated in your family emergency kit. It's better to have supplies ready and never need them than to need them and not have them. SDG&E has also prepared some videos on fire season planning and general emergency preparedness that can be accessed in the Wildfire and Emergency section of our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.